HW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations with Jeff Stein and Gene Meserve.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
And I'm Jean Meserve. Welcome to another episode of Spy Talk.
And it's Ukraine, Ukraine, Ukraine again this week as the world holds its breath over a possible Russian invasion of that beleaguered former Soviet republic. I'll have more on that in a bit with former CIA Russia hand John Cypher. But first, Jean.
Jeff, I don't know if you watched Saturday Night Live, but last weekend the cold open was all about Russian misinformation and Ukraine.
Take a look at these posts that are circulating on Ukrainian Facebook. Ukrainian border encroaching on Russian troops.
Russian forces surrounding Ukraine just to give it big hug.
Ukrainian president horny for drama, wants war, slap me harder, dandy.
I'm gonna break my New Year's resolution and say, malarkey.
Unfortunately, Russia's exploits with disinformation are no laughing matter. We are going to talk about how Vladimir Putin and his agents are trying to influence the conversation about Ukraine later in the podcast with Brian Murphy of Logically.
Spy movie aficionados will, of course, recognize this as the theme music to the Cold War classic, The Hunt for Red October. And it does feel more than a bit Cold War-ish today, doesn't it, as Russian troops, tanks, and weaponry mass on Ukraine's borders? The CIA, of course, formed the cutting edge for the U.S. against the Soviet Union until its demise in 1991, and has carried the battle again against Russia under an aggressive Vladimir Putin. So I called up John Cypher, who once ran CIA operations against the Russians, to talk about the spy agency's options for dealing with the Kremlin today. John Cypher, welcome to Spy Talk. It's just great to have you here. Let me take you back a few months, or maybe a little bit more, to when Vladimir Putin started his buildup. You're on seventh floor of CIA headquarters in Langley. What are you thinking? What's the mood? And what are you recommending?
Well, if you're talking about his first buildup last spring, or if you're talking about the one that's led to this threat of an invasion, probably when both of those first started, my advice would be he's doing it again. This is classic Vladimir Putin pattern of behavior. What he does is he creates a full crisis, and then hopes to get some sort of concessions or have people come to him. You know, it's sort of a slightly more sophisticated version of what Kim does in North Korea. You know, when doesn't seem to be getting paid attention to, he shoots several missiles off or something. But And Vladimir Putin, you know, in the last, you know, 10 years or so, he's tried to, you know, he escalates, he creates some sort of crisis. He has us sort of come to him. And what's happened in the past is we've tended to accommodate him or give him an off ramp or, you know, move to him in some set of space so that, you know, maybe he'll change, maybe he'll come around. Well, by 2021, 2022, we know who Vladimir Putin is. We know he never comes around. He's not going to change. And so my advice would be with this new one is you're never going to accommodate him. He's never going to be satisfied. You need to start thinking hard about deterring him. And deterring him means there has to be threats that he takes seriously.
Okay, let's take it back around the circle to seventh floor at Langley. You can't say, let's go out and recruit some more agents tomorrow. I mean, that's not the way intelligence and espionage works. That's a long game of spotting and recruiting and managing a spy. So what do you think the tools are for intelligence agencies? Obviously, we're going to step up satellite coverage. NSA is going to step up listening to Russian communications and so on. But what do you think the discussion was like at CIA when the first buildup began and then the second one?
Well, let me just step back to talk about your first point. It's an excellent point. you know, one large part of the agency is the human collection part of the agency. And, you know, as you know very well, that's a very fragile ecosystem that, you know, we oftentimes take years and years to find sources and develop them into certain places where they can give us access to things we can't get any other way. We can't get through the satellites. We can't get through radio listening. We can't get through diplomatic means or any other. And sometimes you have those sources and, you know, they might last for a while. And if they go away, you may never get them in that place again. And Russia's especially tough because the Russians are, you know, Vladimir Putin's a KGB officer. They have a massive, massive counterintelligence and intelligence infrastructure. They're very focused on playing games and trying to stop Westerners learning what they're up to. It's sort of a legacy of their Czechist and Soviet past, KGB past. They're all over our diplomats and others and intelligence officers in Moscow, following them everywhere. So Moscow is especially hard place to get human intelligence. And when we do, we're really lucky. And if we start to lose that, we're in trouble. And so, you know, I think the Trump times, there was, you know, reportedly, I don't know because I'm out of the agency now and wouldn't know, but there was some talk about some sources in the Kremlin that had to actually flee because of the way Trump was speaking and putting them at risk. So we might find ourselves in a really tough position here that we don't really have the kind of eyes and ears that we might want to have in the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. So what would we do? I think we would do, you know, what we do in the past is try to work with our analysts, because the analysts are pulling in information from everywhere, from the NSA and from satellites and from diplomats and business travelers and politicians and others, to try to put together a pattern. And I think what they would find is the pattern I mentioned to you earlier. Vladimir Putin has been consistent. He's consistently been at war with the West. He's consistently been in a political war against the United States. He's consistently had a zero-sum view where anything that hurts the United States is good for him. And so I think they would understand that in this case, you know, he's trying, you know, we're not going to be able to appease him. We can only find a way to make it clear that the pain he will suffer if he takes the actions he claims he's going to take might deter him from action.
It would be great to learn somewhere down the road that we had a top spy inside the Kremlin, inside Putin's circle. Not likely at this point. Some of the sources, like you say, reportedly that we had fled Russia. Anyway, it would be great if we had someone stealing the memos off Putin's desk, but not likely. But one of the priorities of U.S. intelligence as a whole, of course, not just CIA, is to provide early warning of an attack. So you would expect that there'd be a priority put out. A bulletin would be going out to all CIA, relevant CIA stations, to bear down on Russia's military infrastructure, to find hints of any attack that's coming. Am I right about that?
Oh, you're absolutely right. And our military intelligence infrastructure and CIA and NSA are quite good at what they do, and they've been doing it for a long time. You know, as you well know too, nowadays open source reporting is much more vibrant and more extensive than it ever was in the past. You see the things that like Bellingcat and these others can report by putting together, you know, inputs from big data and looking at, you know, Facebook feeds and people's pictures and using data, like we've seen people reporting openly about, you know, blood supplies moving to the front. And there's been lots of photos of, you know, literally just citizens taking pictures of Russian trains moving to the front and posting them and then finding their way into you know, journalism and others. So, you know, the key for our intelligence service is not just to only look at their own information, but to pull it all together and try to see what's happening. And what's especially hard, I mentioned earlier that collecting intelligence information is hard in Moscow. But what's especially hard here is it has to do with sort of one man, Vladimir Putin. You know, even if we had sources in their foreign ministry and around the Kremlin, that doesn't mean that we're in Vladimir Putin's brain. And at the end of the day, in a dictatorial system, he's the one that's going to decide. And mm-hmm. So it's really hard to predict.
Mm-hmm. Feels like September 1939 all over again. Speaking of tracking Russian military movements, we have reports now that he's pulling back some of these units. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time looking at sort of the history of Russian intelligence operations. And again, Putin is a Czechist, which means, you know, he takes the legacy of the Bolshevik Cheka, which is the original, you know, special services, secret services of the Soviet regime that they celebrate every December. He was the head of the FSB, the massive internal security service of Russia, and a career KGB officer. The KGB has always been involved in what they call active measures, sort of a version of what we call covert action, where they're trying to send signals or trying to send false signals and use disinformation and propaganda and agitation and all these other kind of things. And so I'm hoping that our analysts are clever enough to see which things might be, you know, means of trying to signal or throwing disinformation into the atmosphere to see how it's picked up. So it's really hard to say, you know, you see one piece of information and then draw conclusions from it when you deal with the Russians, because they're always playing this sort of double game.
Mm-hmm. One of those movements may be, of course, what we've been expecting for some time now is Russian aggression onto Ukrainian territory, or more of Ukrainian territory. Over at the Spy Talk newsletter, we've addressed the issue of paramilitary trainers from the West, principally the U.S., and some from the U.K., preparing Ukrainians for guerrilla warfare against the Russians. What's your take on that? What kind of prospects do you see for that being successful?
Well, it depends what you mean by successful. I mean, I think it's necessary. I think working with the Ukrainians to professionalize their military, to professionalize their paramilitary and their intelligence services and their paramilitary services is very important. If in fact Vladimir Putin chooses to try to occupy Ukraine, having an insurgency, a guerrilla warfare capability is very important to try to bleed the Kremlin, you know, sort of like what happened to us in Afghanistan and other places.
Or what we did to the Red Army in Afghanistan in the 1980s.
No, absolutely true. So But, you know, when we talk about that as success, that often takes a long time. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of blood and pain and refugees and damage and damage to economies and oil flows and all these other, other things in the meantime. So I don't count on that being, you know, definitive. I hope it's just another layer of something that Vladimir Putin has to take into consideration. The problem is, I think Vladimir Putin assessed us as weak. I think after pulling out of Afghanistan, he looks at our internal politics after January 6th and other things. He sees that the American political body is not cohesive, that there's people actually working against the administration inside. And I think he took these things together to think that, hey, you know, now might be a good time. The West is weak. And so we didn't have a lot of tools to push deterrence. But since that time, we've really tried to pull the NATO team together. There's been military movements. We've talked about putting more American weapons and troops into Europe. Just like your reporting said, that we're doing more paramilitary training. I think all those things together are part of a effort to deter him from acting, but we're not going to know, you know, until we see what he does. Mm-hmm. I'm of the view that it's incredibly stupid to invade or to attack Ukraine. I think that's a roll of the dice that he just doesn't know if he can control. You know, he doesn't know what kind of pushback he'll get from Ukraine. He doesn't know what it means if he's an international pariah and his economy is turned off. He doesn't know, you know, how that'll affect his, you know, him inside his own country. And I think that's the thing that's most important to him.
He's been an international pariah for some time, certainly since he invaded, seized Crimea, the attacks on the U.S. electoral system, which are continuing,
we still go back and meet him. There's still these sort of summit meetings, and he comes to all the various leaders meetings around Europe and all these other kind of things. They still operate fully in the, you know, economic system, even though there's been individual sanctions. I don't think we've turned it on to make him a pariah in the sense that Iran or North Korea is, and that's what he might be facing if he invades.
We ran a piece, as you know, a couple of days ago, saying that China offers Putin an out against sanctions if China so decides to do so. What do you think of that?
Yeah. And I think one of the problems for us, you know, trying to deter this time is we've been signaling this for a long time. We've been threatening, oh, you know, you do more, we're going to up the sanctions. We've talked about pulling Russia out of the SWIFT banking network for years now. So he has had time to work with the Chinese and others to try to find ways to avoid that pain, to be prepared for that type of thing. And as you've reported, there's been discussions with the Chinese and others, and the Chinese have the economic capability to do that. I tend to think that the sort of vaunted Chinese-Russian relationship is less than it appears to the outside. I think Putin fears China. China is, you know, winning the 21st century. China is growing. China needs the international economic order because they're winning, because they succeed. They're making money off of it. Russia is trying to upend it and turn it all over because they're losing. They're losing the 21st century. So yes, China could help, but you know, really Russia is just a blip to China. Like, they may help, they may choose not to. It's a hell of a gamble to bet that the Chinese are going to bail you out.
Well, we can't punish the Chinese like we have the Russians, or maybe contemplating to do more if he invades. And China may well see this as an opportunity to punish us again, to gang up on us a little bit more. I bet that's really tempting to Xi Jinping.
You're right. I mean, that's the one thing they have in common, is they have a common enemy. And so, you know, that said, China has often been very careful in terms of really provoking and pushing. And so remains to be seen. I hope we don't have to find out what they might do. I hope Putin comes to his senses here.
Yeah, we all do. We're in a tight spot now. It's hard to see him crawling back off that ledge. But let me ask you something else. Is Russia, if we end up in a kind of a shooting war with the Russians, or at least an intelligence war, because they've moved to seize at least the territory east of the Dnieper River. So are they vulnerable elsewhere in places like Kazakhstan, where we could light a fire and make some trouble for them? We quoted Robert Manning of the Atlantic Council the other day saying that Putin may be sitting on powder kegs more than client states. What do you think of that?
Well,
is
it's
that
interesting.
Overblown?
Well, I've been sort of pushing this for a while too. You know, one of the things, another pattern of Vladimir Putin's, which dictators tend to do, is they need to have a straw man. They need to have somebody to blame for their problems. So Vladimir Putin has been blaming the United States, the CIA, and the West for interfering in his government, for his economic troubles for a long time. And he knows that we're not interfering in his government. We're not doing the things that he claims daily that we're doing in Russia. But he's a KGB guy. He understands the power of these sort of covert actions and this disinformation and sabotage and all these type of things, subversion, because that's what he does. That's how he uses his government as a weapon. But frankly, we could, you know, I'm
yeah, I was going to say, let's turn the tables. You're a CIA guy. You know, all these tools too, disinformation, sabotage, espionage, and so on. And it's just natural for people and certainly institutions like CIA and military institutions to say, let's do something. Let's make some trouble for him. Right. I mean,
you can imagine that
conversation taking place
so.
At your old outfit out in Langley.
Yes, I think so. And I, you know, in the past, I think the U.S. government in the 50s and 60s went to this way too much and it backfired. But I think this is a weapon that
it was very unsuccessful.
Yeah.
Early CIA efforts against the Soviet Union were notoriously unsuccessful.
That's correct.
So what makes you think that if we did it again, to light some fires inside Russia or Russia's client states, that we'd have more success?
Because I don't think Russia is nearly as powerful as the Soviet Union is. I think Vladimir Putin understands that, you know, he's in a precarious situation. It's, you know, he's essentially been stealing from his people, and there's a small group of oligarchs and cronies around him that have been as well. And so they have to worry, you know, about, to a certain extent, the population, you know, seeing what's happening in these other countries and maybe rising up. I mean, it's something that he's feared for a long time. He's feared these color revolutions. It's one of the reasons he wants to go into Ukraine, because he sees, you know, a successful Ukraine as a threat as a model to perhaps his own people. Same with going into Kazakhstan. So, you know, I can imagine going to Vladimir Putin and saying, listen, you know, we haven't been playing these covert games, but if you want us to fund every type of opposition to you around the world, if you want us to be trying to undercut your government from the inside, if you want us to be fomenting problems in all of these countries around, not, you know, you claim we're doing all these terrible things in Ukraine, you know, we're not, but we can. And we can do it in all the countries around. I think it's something he would understand.
But Vladimir Putin has said all along that, or accused the U.S. all along of sparking these color revolutions, that we covertly aided them, that they were a tool of the CIA. Has he got a point?
But I think that's also part of, you know, lying to his population to try to protect himself. He knows. I mean, he's got a worldwide intelligence apparatus. He's got sources around the world. We know, for example, how successful he was messing with our elections in 2016 and how he has such a good sense of American politics that he can find our weaknesses, exploit them, and amplify them to his benefit. So I think he has a good understanding of what the West is doing, what the West can do to him. And he understands that we haven't been fomenting those things. We publicly, our public diplomacy has supported, you know, Georgian independence and things in Ukraine and these other kind of things. And certainly he dislikes that. So I understand that. But the notion that we're doing some sort of covert activity to support these countries against Russia, I believe he understands that that's not true.
Or that we may not have really put the pedal to the metal there.
Yeah, so we could. Like, again, we could.
What more could Putin do to hurt us domestically? He was pretty successful in 2016. He's helped create chaos here. Is there more that he could do?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, you know, much of what we're seeing now is a match to dry tinder. It's not too hard in the United States to see what people are attacking each other over, whether it has to do with issues related to Trump, whether it has issues related to race, whether it has any sort of political issues. All he has to do is, you know, have his people find things that are upsetting and creating passion and chaos in tribal chaos in the political system and exploit it. And so I don't think that's too hard. I think you continue to do that. Cyber attacks are also very proficient and very good. Obviously, as we know, he could ramp that up. But at the end of the day, these things can come back to him too. We haven't attacked him with, you know, serious mm-hmm. cyber attacks. And we could do so. Yeah,
I'm from what I know about our cyber capabilities, we could turn out the lights in Moscow, make them flicker a little bit, send him a message, turn off one of his refineries.
Well, I think the Bush administration and the Obama administration continued to never want to really push back hard against Putin because they thought he would come around. They thought either it must be a misunderstanding and partly our problem, or that we could reset and Vladimir Putin would understand the benefit of that. You know, again, now we've had 20 years of him. We understand that he sees the West as an enemy. He wants to set himself up as the opposite of the West. And so those things don't work. We get that. And so now is the time to actually look to create that kind of pain rather than, you know, hold back hoping that he's going to change, because he's not going to change.
Well, a tinderbox of this, and we can only hope that the U.S. and NATO and the Russians find a way to step back off the ledge and solve this problem peacefully to everyone's satisfaction. But it looks kind of grim, as we talk.
It does look grim. But we have to remind ourselves, too, that this is completely manufactured crisis. The things that he's claiming that are a problem have been this exact same issues for the last 25 years. Like, Ukraine has been an independent country for 30 some years. Ukraine is not anywhere closer to joining NATO than they were 5-10 years ago. There's nothing new in terms of military push towards his borders like he claims. In fact, the U.S. was pulling out of Europe, you know, in all ways, to include our tanks and everything else, up until 2014 when he invaded Ukraine and took Crimea. And even since then, we've only put in sort of brigade size groups to work in Europe. And so, you know, the things that he's claiming are problems have been the same issue for 30 years. It's almost like he believes that that the United States and the West humiliated the Soviet Union, humiliated Russia after the Soviet Union fell. And because of our weakness, now it's his turn to humiliate us. And so, you know, we just can't put up with that. We got to push back.
John Cypher, thanks so much for being with us today. Let's keep our fingers crossed that there's a peaceful resolution here. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's former senior CIA operations officer John Cypher. Gene?
You know, Jeff, we hear John Cypher talk about how Vladimir Putin uses disinformation as a tool. We're going to have more on that in just a moment. A reminder to subscribe to our podcast and also subscribe to Spy Talk on Substack and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Gene Meserve. Jeff, you're at
Spy Talker.
We'll be back in just a moment. War isn't just about moving troops and physical assets. It has always had a psychological component. And in this social media age, it has become easier to play mind games. Russia and its intelligence operatives are expert. We saw them sow myths and disinformation during the 2016 U.S. election, for instance. Now they are planting doubts and encouraging division over Ukraine. We talked to Brian Murphy, a former FBI and DHS official who is now vice president of strategic operations for Logically. He says Russia's efforts to manipulate the Ukraine situation through social media are extensive.
It's definitely different and it's definitely intense.
Where are they targeting it? I presume Ukraine first and foremost. What are you seeing in that space?
So I think they're targeting largely the Russian population and the ethnic Russians living in Ukraine, trying to build a base or a justification for war or intervention. That's their, I think, their primary objective.
Are they trying to change minds of other Ukrainians?
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they're hoping to change the minds of, let's say, the rest of Ukraine's and non-ethnic Russians. But it's from what we've seen that those minds are probably made up. And I don't think that's the primary objective.
Are they trying to undermine faith in the government?
They are always doing that. I think they come at that a number of ways, such as cyber attacks, beyond the mis- and disinformation space. But absolutely, that would be part of their business process.
So let's talk about where else they're doing this. Are you seeing Russian entities trying to influence the social media conversation and opinion elsewhere in Europe?
Yeah, so I think, again, their primary target is that Russian-speaking audience to gain that base of support. But the secondary aspect of this particular campaign is to bring out things to, for example, one of their themes is neo-Nazism within Ukraine, to undermine the will of largely Western Europe and the United States. To stand behind Ukraine as a partner that we'd want to support. They're trying to show the underside of, in their minds, of the Ukrainian culture and its people.
So explain, can you give me an example of what they'd be highlighting?
There are a couple of key figures in the Ukrainian political, historical, and cultural worldview that are founding figures and important to the current Ukraine identity. Some of those people are former members of the Nazi Party during World War II. And so they are celebrated and at some level within Ukraine as historically important figures for Ukraine. And at the same time, they were indeed Nazis. So that's how the Russians try to amplify and show what the other side of Ukraine is, if you will.
How are the Europeans reacting, do you know, to the disinformation?
I think that individuals like yourself in the press and, let's say, what the State Department done in other countries have done a great job to identify what these strands are that the Russians are trying to push. It's hard to measure how the European population sees that, but the more we expose these, that's the best defense is good daylight on these types of dis- and misinformation campaigns. And of course, people will make their own judgments from there. Some people will not agree with the Ukrainian past, and that may influence how they think about it now or not, but they'll at least have the facts to know why this is coming around now.
What's happening in Russia? Is Russia promoting disinformation to its own population?
So the Russian mis- and disinformation campaign is always first and foremost centered within Russia. That's where it started. centuries ago. And that's really the most important context by which they carry out these campaigns. Domestic population first has always been the target and will likely remain the target of the Russian government.
So what are they trying to persuade them of in this moment?
There's a couple of narratives that they're producing. And the point of that is that this will be a righteous war. It's a defensive war on behalf of the Russian government and the Russian ethnic Russians. And it fits in line with what Putin and other thought leaders within the Russian establishment, academia, news, et cetera, the idea that these ethnic Russians are part of what they call Ruskiy Mir, or the Russian world, and need to be protected no matter what borders they lie within.
Is it building support for the war as far as you can see, or the potential war?
I think that's their attempt. It's hard for us to measure how effective it is, except to say that the war and the potential war is widely accepted as a positive thing within Russia. So, whether this particular campaign, how much it's been influential, I don't think we know. But what we do know is that the war itself is very popular, well-received within Russia. Those narratives are having, at some level, an effect and a part of the Russian strategy.
Are you seeing Russian disinformation in the United States?
So I think we as consumers of social media are always subject to picking up information perpetuated by the Russians. So yeah, we've certainly seen a bleed over as the narratives get laundered within multiple countries, including the United States.
So how much are you seeing here? Is it more or less activity than you saw, let's say, around the election?
I don't know if we have those answers quite yet because the campaign's still ongoing. And what I would say, it's certainly present, but we're not at a place where we can necessarily compare and contrast it to, let's say, the elections of either 2020 or 18 or 16.
We have seen some mainstream media figures repeating some of the Russian line on this conflict. What's your reaction when you see someone, let's say, like Tucker Carlson, parroting the Russians?
Well, I think, this is right falls into the Russian playbook, right? They will put out their point of view in terms of how they articulate their stance on things. And part of that should be news, right? In the sense of like, it's newsworthy. How individual commentators interact with that is kind of the next part of it. And it really depends on, in my perspective, how objective those reporters are and kind of how they discuss it. A lot of reporting in the US and other countries plays into this is a catch-22, can play into the Russian narrative. And we, meaning the press, would be unwittingly helping or facilitating their narrative. But the weird dynamic here is that there is a responsibility for the press, and it may be good for the Russians, but it still may be things that the press has an obligation or desire to put out.
Can you give me an example?
So any hot button political issue in the United States, they're going to try to amplify it and make it more divisive. One of the examples that I'll go back to is during the summer of 2020, we saw the Russians amplifying narratives about the murder of George Floyd. It doesn't mean that they're right or wrong and how the press covered it in terms of the narratives, because what the Russians were largely putting out was already existing stories that other US persons were either putting out or factual stories. They wanted to amplify the story. That's their goal in that case. So it's the polarization they are in today's world most after. And it's a tricky situation. And I don't think any of us got the full answer on how to respond to that. I think the press is much further on guard than they were years ago. And they're very careful about what they're reporting. I'm not saying they weren't careful before. I'm simply saying they're more sensitive to these underhanded disinformation techniques.
Are you seeing the Russians use any new tactics or techniques? As an example, for years there's been worry about the use of deepfakes, doctored audio or video. Are you seeing that or something else that represents a different stage in this whole disinformation fight?
Yeah, there's really two parts that I think are a shift in their strategy and tactics. The first is they have pivoted to much more of these kind of gray news channels, which are either directly backed by the Russian government or more likely, I don't know if it's more unlikely, I don't know that answer, have a relationship that is either covert or directly known to them. And these are the smaller outlets that you'll see, and it's hard to determine what their objectives are and who funds them. That is one thing. The second part of it is they certainly are looking to make a place in on Facebook and Twitter or the, whatever the household name for social media is, but they are more active in social media platforms that don't quite do policing of their platforms in the way, let's say, some of these bigger corporations do. So they've moved off of a lot of this, these kind of Twitters and Facebooks. Again, they're still would hope they get success there and into smaller platforms and gray news sites so they can launder their narratives and then hope they appear on larger sites.
So those smaller outlets and those smaller media channels might be what?
Well, I mean, for example, we look at Telegram, not saying that, for example, that the, I don't know fully, you know, how the Russians look at Telegram, but Telegram generally does not do a whole lot of policing of their sites as we see it. And we're not talking about the encrypted side of Telegram. We're talking about when Telegram is open to the public. There are a lot of conspiratorial, you know, things on there, downright falsehoods, you know, some level of violent speak. And those are the types of sites the Russians are going to gravitate towards. In terms of gray news sites, there was some really good work done by a number of reporters in the U.S. Fort Russ, which is, I think, a well now identified gray news site out in, I believe, California, somewhere, I think it's California. Those sites tend to take the Russian narrative and put it out as if it's their own or launder it through their sites, and it can get some traction from there.
Who is promulgating the Russian disinformation? Is it the government? Is it their proxies?
So in the world of disinformation, where we've moved from is, for the most part, into paid for services. And there are a number of companies throughout the world that you can find easily on the internet. I don't think it's illegal in most countries. And you pay them for a disinformation campaign. And many of these companies are low-cost countries. And for a couple thousand, you'll get your disinformation campaign of du jour. And, you know, that's a good starting place for, let's say, the Russians and others to come in from a covert perspective and, you know, hand over money and tell these individuals what they want done. And it happens. So I think those cutouts are key.
So we've been concerned, the West, about disinformation coming from Russia and elsewhere for years. Are we getting any better at coping with it, at dealing with it, at blunting its impact?
I think we are at some, and in certain areas. Where I think, let's say for the United States, we have a long way to go is we are not in a place where we have a winning strategy for the long run. And what I mean by that is a lot of what we do is whack a troll. And you know, where they pop up somewhere, either the social media companies will push them down, but they reappear somewhere else. And that kind of game will continue, you know, for a long time. Or they'll drop off social media and appear on gray news sites in terms of what they're doing now. So I don't know that we have that strategy, but we are making strides in terms of the social media metadata and kind of spying those campaigns. And I think from a societal view, not a governmental position, but a societal view, we're talking about it more often, which is good. It leads to, I think, some awareness.
Is disinformation going to be part of any future conflict?
I think for the foreseeable future, it will absolutely play a role in that sliding scale that countries can deploy. It's not necessarily new, right? We've seen propaganda as part of a nation's toolkit, but the ability to project it into your adversary's backyard or across the world has changed. It's just the scale, the scope, and the speed is just unmatched right now. So it's also, there's also no cost for the most part for countries laundering these narratives at present. So it's a low cost in terms of dollar and cents to build a campaign. It's low cost politically for the most part to launch a campaign. So why wouldn't you?
That was Brian Murphy, Vice President of Strategic Operations for Logically, formerly with the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. Jeff?
Yeah, it's so troubling. You know, we've seen no end to this Russian meddling in our social sphere, our political sphere. And not only the Russians, of course, but the Chinese, the Iranians, North Koreans are all musking around in our social media. It's gotten to a point where some people are calling for a radio-free America to kind of try to combat this disinformation. But, you know, that brings its own problems. The U.S. government's forbidden to propagandize Americans, and they get their word out through the media, but somehow it just isn't getting through to the anti-science, anti-government crowds that are, you know, just crippling our responses to COVID and in trying to get our political system on an even keel. So I don't know what the way forward is, but I think we'll come back to this issue. We'll address it in a subsequent podcast of how the government and private industry might collaborate together to do a more forceful rebuttal to all this disinformation.
And listen, media organizations have a part to play too, as we talked about in the podcast. There are some people on television who are promoting this mis and disinformation.
Oh, yeah. And then there's the Joe Rogans of the world in social media.
Yep. It is a really complex quandary we find ourselves in. That's it for this edition of Spy Talk. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Good to have you here for another week. Thanks for tuning in to Spy Talk. And we hope to see you back here next week. Thanks. I'm Jeff Stein.
And I'm Jean Meserve.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.